The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
Hi, this is Candace Michelle, and welcome to another segment of Our Community. You know, we have the most amazing group of dedicated volunteers at our station, many of whom have their own shows, but also quite a few who work quietly behind the scenes, recording, editing, keeping our social media and website current, and myriad other tasks involved in running a radio station that's on air 24/7. Today, I'm joined by two gentlemen, and I use the term loosely, guys, who not only work behind the scenes, serving on our board of directors and help others produce shows, but who both produce shows of their own. I have great pleasure in welcoming Ray Gary, who has a music show, What's Going On, and Dan Sherman, the producer and host of Discussions at Brookings Cafe. It's great to have you both here.
It's great to be here.
Nice to be here.
So, we've worked together for about a year now, I think, and I don't actually know your stories. I mean, I know some of it, you know, little bits and pieces, but I don't actually know the stories, so I would like to.
Dan should go first, because mine is going to be a tough act to follow.
Oh, okay.
I brought in a 38-page resume.
And did you bring your photo album?
I did not.
Okay.
I forgot it. I couldn't find it. It's still in a box in the garage somewhere.
Uh-oh.
Because you did email
me. I've seen that garage.
Oh, yeah. So he'll never find it.
Never find it.
Right. So you did email me that you were going to bring your photo album from your childhood.
Yes.
That showed your bicycle.
And my cowboy hat.
And your cowboy hat.
Cowboy hat. Okay. I may have even been wearing my cap gun at the time, too.
Oh, yeah, God. That was I remember big-time cowboy those. Then. I remember those. My brother had a cap gun.
Yeah.
Oh,
great
God.
Fun when you're 10.
I think we are definitely.
We all figured out how to make it fire 3 or 4 caps at a time, so it was really loud.
you even sound like
stuff them in
like
behind the hammer. And
I remember the modification, yeah. Fold them over You could fold them over and yep. Just kind of set them in there, and they would do that.
I vaguely do remember that. So, Dan, where were you raised?
Oh, a little here and there. I was a child of a broken home. I was tossed around between my mom and my dad and my grandparents. And
should I be sad that you were
absolutely
a child of a broken? Okay.
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. And so I didn't go to the same school until I was in the 9th grade, and then finally I went on there. So I've been a lot of places.
So wait a minute.
You mean
that you change schools like every year?
Yeah.
Wow.
A couple of times a year, maybe 3 times. I would start school, and then my mom and dad would have a thing, and they'd ship me off to the grandparents until they ironed it out. And so I would shift schools as well. And
God,
so,
it must have been really, I would find that very rough. I mean, having to make new friends every 6 months.
I guess.
Unless you didn't make any friends.
That was a long time ago
know.
In a galaxy far away.
Okay.
I don't remember much
okay.
about it.
All of my teachers would have liked me to change schools every year.
Yeah.
You were one of those, huh?
Yes.
That's sad.
But I did have a fairly stable junior high school and high school. And then once I got off on my own, all hell broke loose, and it's a really wild and crazy story from there as well, I guess. I don't know. I've done a lot of things.
What part of the country were you doing
I was born in East Orange, New Jersey. My father was in the Army at the time. The war had just ended. He was training to be a fighter pilot, and the war ended, so they made him an orderly in the hospital in New Jersey where returning troops were coming. And so I was born there because he was married at the time, and my mom was pregnant with me. And other than that, I haven't been there at all. I was raised in Florida. I was raised in Oklahoma. I was raised in Michigan. I had a brief stint in Los Angeles, California. and various other parts of the world, or the country, the United States, as I was traveling through or whatever. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of the countryside as a child.
What about you, Ray? Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Brooklyn, and when I was
Brooklyn, really?
Yes, yes. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, my family joined the White Flight to move out to Long Island, out to Central Long Island, Bethpage, where I lived on a 60 by 100 plot surrounded by thousands of other 60 by 100 plots with Cape Cod houses on them. And I still found my little adventures in the backyard, and there's an occasional vacant lot or some wooded areas where I could go and play.
Thank God for the woods.
Oh, yes. I know.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in the woods, especially in Florida. I have all these memories of the pine trees and the lying on the forest floor, if you will, in the pine needles and listening to the wind blowing. And interestingly, when I was in the Army, my training, a lot of it was in Georgia. And when I was there, I had that same experience, and I loved it.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah. I remember
childhood memories.
Vacant lots. There was a vacant lot across the street from us and a vacant lot right down the street on the corner. I must have spent almost all my time in those vacant lots.
We played baseball on one of those vacant lots, a 60 by 100 lot. We played it with three bases.
Now, I played baseball in Florida, and this is a little different because in Florida, there are orange trees everywhere, and you cannot tell the difference between a baseball and a rotten orange when it's coming at you at speed. And, of course, everybody, the way that you can tell is the catcher steps away from the plate. And then you know it's coming.
Okay, that's kind of disgusting.
It was.
So you basically grew up in New York then?
Yeah, until I was drafted. I'd been to New Jersey once or twice, and I think I went as far as Connecticut, and that's it as far as my ventures any place. So I was pretty provincial New York, Long Island kid, thought that was the world. But I always knew there was another world someplace. And as a kid, I used to love Frank Buck movies and all that, thought I was going to be an adventurer someday. I was very into reptiles and amphibians, which I still kind of am. And I would go out and discover new species.
And have you discovered any?
No, I have a lot of pictures of that nobody cares to look at, are snakes and frogs and stuff.
Some of us are not as fond of snakes as you might be.
He's a biologist at heart.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So people ask me why I'm into snakes, and I say, well, why is somebody into birds?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing.
It is the same thing, sort of.
Yeah.
You know.
Actually, reptiles and birds are fairly closely related.
Mm-hmm.
But not related to amphibians at all. Amphibians are
a different
whole other thing. They're studied by the same people called herpetologists because they share a common habitat.
Hmm.
God, all the things that I don't know that
Well, I could tell you more. Do you want to hear more about
it? No, that's perfectly okay.
I want to hear about the biggest snake you've ever seen.
Seen?
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen some big snakes. I think the biggest, I have a picture of me at home with I'm holding him up with about a foot of snake above my hand, and he's almost touching the ground. So.
Oh, my God.
And you're a tall guy, so that's a pretty long
right?
snake.
Yeah. What kind of a snake is it?
I knew you would ask me that.
Because you don't know?
Good. It was a yellow rat snake. That's what it was.
Yellow rat snake?
Yes.
Do they specialize in killing rats?
No, it's their preferred food. They're little animals like that. I think they'll probably eat snakes and other things.
Do you think I could get one and have it kind of live under my house or something?
They make good pets. Yes.
Do they? Excellent.
I don't know if he'd stay under your house necessarily.
Be the way to cut down on the rat population in the world. Yeah. So,
that, by the way, when we were looking for a place to move to, one of the first things I checked into in Brookings was what kind of reptiles and amphibians there are here. And a big downside was there are no venomous snakes here.
And that was downside?
That's
for
the
you?
Downside?
I'm really sorry.
We were buying a house in Tucson, and I told the realtor that a house with snakes would be a plus. She didn't sit close to me anymore after that.
I don't understand that at all. Yeah. Wow. So your childhoods basically were fun, although not yours, Dan, that's...
Oh, I thought it was fun. No, I was, you know, I was 8 and 9 at the time, and I'll tell you a quick little story. I think I was 9 years old, and I was going to this little country school in Florida that was away from the city, and we rode a bus to get there, and I don't know how far it was. I'm sure it was uphill both ways, but at any rate, I remember going to go do overnights with friends that I had at school. And one of the guys that I went over to his house, I didn't realize this at the time, but he lived in a shack.
Huh.
It was a little two-room shack. He had his own little room. The other one was basically the living room and a bedroom. And anyway, the shack was made out of old pine boards.
Huh.
And what I liked about it was that we could throw our knives into the wall and stick them, and nobody cared. And they had an outhouse, and that was fun.
Oh,
and they
God.
Had a pump, and trying to get that to work was a challenge. And no, at the time, being 8 and 9 years old, I thought that was all great fun. It was just experience.
Right.
And I didn't realize I was poor.
It's kind of good.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So you both kind of grew up. And
no,
you didn't. Neither one of you grown up, right? You're both still kids.
We're both right. guys.
So you remember the Peter Pan thing, right? I won't grow up. I won't grow. Yeah, it's my theme song. Yeah, I love that song. Okay, so but you did like eventually get to the point where you were military age, right?
Yes. Greetings, your friends and neighbors. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I took. My physical initially, I don't know, I was 19 or whatever, about when most people take them. The same place Harlow Guthrie took his physical, and so I can really relate to that song. But I wasn't smart enough to go out and get drunk and drugged up the night before, so they took me. No, I was originally, I got the letter in the mail a week or two later saying I was 1Y. And I was just thrilled. That, oh, good, I'm not going to get drafted. And then I got concerned. What the hell is 1Y and what's wrong with me? So I called them up, and they said, well, right now we're only taking the very, very best candidates, and because you wear glasses, we don't want you right now. So I said, oh, good. I got married and bought a car and all the things you don't do because you're going to get drafted, and they increased the troops in Vietnam, and all of a sudden I was 1A. They didn't care if I wore glasses.
The seeing eye, the guy behind me, he flunked the physical because his seeing eye dog had flat feet.
Those physicals were incredibly thorough and accurate. And I wound up in medic school, which was different because I told them, I pass out when I see blood. And they say, oh, don't worry. You just go down there to Fort Sam Houston and they'll take care of that. And yeah. But anyway, in the classes, we would practice procedure on the guy at the next table, and we were doing blood pressure one day, and the instructor, okay, well, what did you get, you know, and everybody, you know, were all young, and the one guy had 200 over something, and the instructor got all mad, and he thought that the student had done it wrong, and he did it 2 or 3 times, and then the instructor did it, and so here's this guy, like 20-something years old, and he says, I tried to tell him I had high blood pressure, and they gently picked him up, and we never saw him again.
Oh, left. My God.
But that's how thorough the physicals are, that they missed something like that.
Oh,
they needed people really badly.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Vietnam, that was, what an era that was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So were you both in country?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And where were you, Dan?
We have shared stories. I was in the military police, and so that meant they could put us on guard duty 24/7, essentially.
Wow.
And I started off in a place called Long Bend, which was the Army headquarters for the whole operation in Vietnam. And then they transferred me to a little town called Benoit, and there I was in a medical clinic. We did patrols. We went out into the field from time to time, escorting engineers, Coca-Cola trucks, weird stuff like that. And then I went, I worked port security in Saigon, and then I went to Cat Lai, which was the ammo offload point. They had 3 ships completely full of explosives they were offloading, and we used to sit on the dock and look at it and say, you know, if that blew, half of Saigon would go away. Because there was a ship explosion in Halifax, which is somewhere up in Canada during the World War I, I think. and destroyed the whole town. It was amazing. So we had healthy respect for the ships, but we escorted the tugboats up the river to the truck depot and things like that. Did town patrol, wrestled with drunks from time to time, and chased people out of restricted areas and whatnot. So,
how long were you there?
A year. I was actually in country 11 months because I went over on a boat. And the boat ride was considered part of the tour.
Oh.
So, you know, the only problem with the boat was that your buddy's bunk was only 3 inches above your nose.
Oh, my God. So. Yeah, that's unfortunate.
I went over on Braniff Airlines, and I think that was considered part of the tour, too, but I don't know.
No.
Probably, yeah.
And so what did you do when you were there, Ray?
I was a medic, so I was initially assigned to a line platoon. With the MOS I had, you could work in a hospital or a clinic or something, or you could work in the field. And of course, I got the work in the field job. And as a medic, you get absolutely no combat training other than the limited stuff you get in basic training. So for quite a while, I had no idea what the hell was going on. I was just stand here and do that. I remember first time we went out on an operation, I walked up to the platoon sergeant and standing next to him, and he had a fit. He said, "Don't you ever stand this close to me again." And he explained that we have to stay 15 meters apart so that one hand grenade won't kill both of us, or we won't become a target then. But then he says, "Doc, I'm going to take care of you, get you out of here alive, and you just take care of me in case I'm needed." And that was a good deal. Worked out very well.
That's a very good
Sergeant
deal.
Sergeant Doss was his name. I wonder if he's still around. Maybe he's in Brookings now listening.
Google.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he's listening.
But anyway, so after being a medic, you're drafted to be a hero. And I was not a hero, and I never volunteered to be a hero.
Didn't want to be.
Every operation, if somebody gets hit, you have to go to where they were hit. And so it was not fun at all. And I was in the field with the infantry for about 7 months of a 12-month tour. And one day we had this thing in the mess hall or in the mess tent where this woman came in, or I think it was a woman, a recruiting person, and explained to us how we could re-enlist and change our MOS. Well, everybody, you know, when you're in the Army, especially like in Vietnam, the last thing you want to do is spend another 15 minutes in the Army. But I was looking at this and saying, well, wait a minute. Now I'm trading 2 years to go to a safer job and increase the likelihood that I'll go home alive, as opposed to staying here and have fairly limited likelihood that I would go home uninjured. So to me, that seemed like a pretty good deal. It still does today, mm-hmm. 50 or 40 years or whatever later. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought I was crazy. But anyway, so then I wound up in the MPs, and it was frying pan into the fire because I was put in a combat MP unit, they called it, and they knew nothing about combat. They knew nothing at all. But
oh, my God.
We would go out on operations and things, and I'd, it was terrifying. And then we did a lot of convoy escorts and things like that.
So you both came home basically in one piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, I unscathed. I didn't get a scratch.
One little scratch.
Excellent.
I'm really fortunate, especially and recently talking to a lot of vets, that I have virtually no problems. I've never even so much as had a dream, let alone a nightmare.
Wow, that's excellent.
Which I'm told is very unusual.
Right.
And I've got the PTSD thing, so.
Yeah.
So it's still with me.
Yeah, well, of course. You know.
There were no safe jobs in Vietnam. Even if you were like in headquarters in Saigon, the potential for you being killed was still there. Not as much as somebody in the field.
Mm-hmm.
But there was sappers, there was what we call here terrorist attacks, mm-hmm. things of that nature, snipers, just there was no safe jobs.
Right. So you get out of the service, and where did you go? What'd you do?
Well, I went to the bar.
McDonald's, for a long time.
McDonald's was first. I have to put in a shameless plug for McDonald's.
Oh,
what
God.
I really wanted was a real hamburger. Actually, there wasn't McDonald's at that time. I don't remember where I got the hamburger, but that was the first thing I wanted was a real hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I went back to school. I had started off going to school out of high school, and I majored in art. And then I thought student union was a much better class to major in. But that one didn't pan out very well.
I remember that very well, student union.
And that's how I wound up in the Army, essentially. Mm-hmm. But then when I got out, I went back to school, and this time I majored in theater.
Ah.
With the intent of getting into television or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And so I did that for a while, and then a friend of mine drafted me, essentially. He said, I just bought a radio station up in upstate New York in Watkins Glen. He says, I want you to come work it with me. I said, okay. So I packed up my bags and away I went. And that's how I wound up working in radio for the very first time.
That's great.
But it was a lot of fun. I really loved it. Mm-hmm. I really did. Yeah.
And from there, where did you go?
From there, I went back to Tulsa because I was married at the time. It was an on-off relationship because I was a kid. I didn't know anything about maintaining a relationship, and neither did she.
Right.
We wound up going back to Tulsa because she wanted to go back home. She was mm-hmm. homesick, so we went back there. I started working at a radio station there. I worked for a couple of radio stations, and then after that, I just got sick of being a disc jockey, essentially. I worked news for a while, and I liked that a lot better. But the disc jockey bit was just, to me, it was like an assembly line job. It was, mm. We had these tape cartridge things mm-hmm. Our music was on, and we'd plug those in the slot, push the button, and when I first started, I thought, oh, what a wonderful job. I can just sit here and listen to music all day. Mm-hmm. Well, after you've heard the same song 1,462 times in a row, you're pretty well sick of it. So you turn the monitors down real low so you know when the song ends,
right.
But you're not interested in listening to the song anymore. And right. So it seemed like all the music just went thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump. And I would say it's 10:22 under cloudy skies. And then I'd push the button and it would go thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump. So I got out of that, and I went into the advertising business, and that was my my main occupation through my adult life in Tulsa. I spent 40 years working advertising in the corporate world and for mom-and-pop organizations, all-size businesses, and political stuff. I did a lot of political stuff.
What about you, Ray? What did you do after you got out of the service?
Well, I came home and went to school on the GI Bill and went back to my old job. I was working for Newsday in circulation, which was an awful job, but they took me right back, so that was good. And then I fulfilled my dream eventually of moving back to Alaska. I spent my last year in the Army in Alaska.
Ah.
And I had majored in police science. They called it a forensic science. And then when I went back to Alaska, I applied for the state troopers and took about a year to go through the whole process and went to work for the state troopers.
So you were a state trooper in Alaska?
Yes.
What is that like?
It can be
cold.
It's what you make of it, and it can be quite an adventure. And that was a big part of my idea, was to be an adventure. I wanted to go out and travel in the Eskimo villages and things like that. And I hated flying, but I liked the adventure of going out on these general aviation airplanes. Little Cessnas and things like that.
Because that's really the only way you get around.
Yes, out there,
Alaska, right?
Yeah, that or a snow machine, or you could walk.
Right.
Now that there's the four-wheelers, I imagine they're going village to village on those. But
mm-hmm.
I really liked working there. I loved the Eskimo people. The things I didn't like about it was flying and all the cases were dealt with in Nome. And the district attorney there didn't care about things that happened in the village, and he would dismiss virtually everything. So it was kind of pointless work we were doing.
That's unfortunate.
Yes, it was unfortunate. And we would complain and complain, but there wasn't really much we could do about it.
What was the living situation like? I mean, were you kind of in the middle of nowhere?
I lived in Nome, which for a bush post at that time was pretty good. Nome was reasonably civilized. We had the state-owned three trailers there that the two troopers, I guess it was four trailers because there was four of us there anyway, including the Fish and Wildlife officer. And those were, for Nome, were very, very comfortable conditions, even though when the wind blew really hard and there was a snowstorm, you'd have a drift in the living room. But this is Nome, so we were pretty happy. We flushed toilets and running water and all that kind of stuff. So We lived on a hill that overlooked the airport, and we kind of called it Knob Hill. That was where the state employees lived. So that was pretty nice. Wasn't too bad. There was no such thing as satellite television, and then we had a cable television that came out of Nome. Tapes were shipped into Nome, and then they played them for us. And the movie that was supposed to start at 7 might start at 7 or 7:15, or maybe it started at 6:50. It was not too uncommon for the movie to just stop because people were calling up saying they didn't like the movie. And they would change the program because it was all just handled there locally.
Oh, that's funny.
So yeah. did your house have pine board walls?
Pine board?
Or some kind of wooden walls?
No, it just had the regular trailer. It was a trailer.
A trailer. Oh.
Yeah.
You had described building some of these sheds and what have you, and so I just knew that you probably took your pocket knife and threw it into the wall.
No.
But you did say that you spent a lot of time building sheds.
Yeah.
And outbuildings.
After I came back from the bush, most troopers spend a couple of years or so in the bush, if they go at all. I'd say to most of them, it's the word strikes terror into their hearts
bush.
For some reason. I don't know why they work for the troopers, because that's part of the deal is you're going to travel. To me, that was the advantage over working in the city. And the troopers have posts all over the state, so you can... You get tired of one place, you can just apply for someplace else. And so anyway, the last place I wound up in, we had a house, a very nice house that the state provided, but my wife said she didn't move to Alaska to live in a subdivision, so she wanted a homestead. So off we went to Homestead, and there was homestead land available to us reasonable distance, within 15 miles or so I could still go to work, but most of the homestead locations were not on the highway or any place you could even get to the highway to get up in the morning and go to work, which we both had to do. But we found a place that was only 3/4 mile off the road and a very steep hill, and we chopped out a road and built a house by ourselves with no electricity or anything and no running water.
You had wood walls, and you could throw your pocket.
There we go. Finally, we get to the wood walls.
It did, but I never thought of the pocket knife.
So did you enjoy it?
You know, it was really, really, really hard because it would get very, very cold there. Not unusual for it to get to 50 below or colder even. In fact, when we still lived in the little town of Healy, we had a period of 3 weeks where it never went above 50 below. And the cold just keeps seeping in. And I mean, now you have ice on the inside of the wall of a well-constructed house that's made the way it's supposed to be made. It was dangerous to go anyplace. I considered anything colder than 30 below. I did no unnecessary travel at all. And my wife's job, I forget what the cutoff was for going in, but I think it was something like 50 below. And to get to her job, which was about 7 or 8 miles from our house, you had to drive through a low-lying canyon where it could be god-awful cold. It would be awful, awful cold. And there were days that she just said, well, I can't go. And sometimes I would take her in the cop car because I had a radio. And if I broke down, I'd still be broke down because nobody else was out there. But
God.
So when we built the homestead, we had some of the same weather conditions. We never had that three-week period, but it was kind of fun to get out yourself and build your little nest, mm-hmm. and then light up a wood stove and stay in this. It was kind of romantic little thing that mm-hmm. we did. Our plan was we were going to work on the house until we got tired of it. You know, it was kind of fun, you know, and Gina thought that laying out a wall was just like sewing. You know, it was a very similar thing. So, when we got tired of doing it or we were falling behind, we would just hire some carpenters. Well, by the time we got tired of doing it, all the carpenters were working. There was nobody available. So we had to just finish it ourselves. And we made bare minimal to live in and moved in. And
wow.
We hauled water. We'd like to do dishes or something. We'd fill up a pan, do the dishes, and then go outside and had a hole where I dumped that. And eventually, over the years, we got running water. We have a septic system, and we eventually put in a well, and we got real electricity. That was the really big thing. Up until then, we had solar panels and a small windmill and a generator. And
So all of that stuff sounds great when you're young.
Yes.
But I cannot imagine doing it now.
Oh, gosh.
Right? The thought of it makes my blood run cold.
A few months before we left, we were in a local coffee shop in Fairbanks, and we ran into a woman who also lived in Healy and did a similar thing. Not exactly, but similar thing. And we all of us sat there and said, why did we do that? And we never did figure it out. No,
yeah,
but it was
the adventure.
You know how you really don't remember the hard stuff that much. There's that song about the times rewritten every line. But when I really think about it, yeah, there was some really nasty hard stuff. You know,
nearly
frostbiting fingers and frostbiting.
Frostbiting.
Yeah.
Biting the frost. I remember there was one time that I was in Chicago. I lived there for almost a year in a suburb, but it got to 80 below, and you literally, you had to pump your own gas Illinois, but you know, you'd get out, you'd put it in, and you'd get back in the car, right? And because you literally could not be outside for any longer than 5 minutes or you'd start to freeze.
Well, we'd go in the store, you go in the supermarket, do your shopping and come out, and the car seat would be frozen solid, you know, the thump. You had to warm everything up.
Things like
the oil would congeal in the pan while you were driving.
Yeah, that's not good.
Fan belts would break.
while you were driving. Which brings the question to me, do diesel engines work in that kind of cold?
Once you got them started, and you had to have, what is it, number one or number two fuel, and if you had the wrong one, it would congeal, it didn't work.
Yeah.
I don't remember, I think number two was for cold weather, and it was also formulated to where if you drove to Anchorage, which was fairly temperate, and you drove into the interior with a tank full of diesel, it might not be suited for below zero weather. So
you don't want to shut it off.
Yeah, I had a diesel for a year, and I didn't keep it. It was too scary.
So what about you, Dan? You were in Oklahoma and went into advertising, and then what?
Well, let's see. The last job I worked, believe it or not, I was a police officer for the state of Oklahoma at a juvenile prison.
What?
Yeah. Well, the economy tanked.
You guys are amazing.
And within 2 weeks, I lost two of my major clients. And I looked at the books and I said, you know, this just isn't going to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And so a friend of mine was working at this Raider Treatment Center was the name of it. And I thought this was a very interesting, it goes along the lines of, you know, the not knowing that I was poor and growing up with kids that lived in shacks. And we lived in a house. I didn't really think about it.
Right.
It was probably a pretty poor house. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. Anyway, I worked for this juvenile prison as a key control officer, which meant that I got in my own little room with a computer, and I did a lot of crisscrossing around the campus to find which key fit which and stuff like that, because that was essentially the job. But what was interesting about it was the kids, because there was one of the counselors came to me one day. We were talking about why the place was crazy, and the guy said, well, the place is crazy because the kids are crazy. And then he said, and the kids are crazy because most of them are crack babies.
Oh.
And then it hit me that these were kids that were born addicted to crack because the mother was addicted to crack, maybe dad too, if dad was even around.
Right.
And what I got to see essentially was why it is that it's so important for kids, especially infants, to have a good, sound, loving, someplace to be secure in those first few years. Mm-hmm. I read something the other day, said 1 to 7, that's when you learn everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if that gets screwed up, then you wind up with kids, teenagers in this case, that just can't fit into society. So in a lot of cases, they just didn't have the brain power to do it. Their brains had been fried from drugs or what have you. I remember some of these kids, you talk to them and they just stare at you.
Oh,
as
wow.
if they didn't understand, and I don't think they did. Other kids, they were in there for murder and rape and burglary and stuff like that, and you could see the psychosis. You could see mm-hmm. what had happened to them in their early formative years. And so even though it was, you know, it wasn't a tough experience, nonetheless, for me, It was the kind of thing that I look back on. It wasn't the ideal job for me, but I wasn't in it for long until I retired, essentially. But the lesson that I learned in sociology, that's invaluable.
No, it's very enlightening.
Yeah.
For a while, I was a foster parent, and that got me into working a lot, being interested in a lot of juvenile cases and working with teenagers. And I can certainly attest to exactly what Dan said. You know, all of these mm-hmm. kids had this poor development early on. And by the time they get into the system, there had to have been a great deal of abuse or mistreatment. And they were pretty well
And this is fried, all use Dan's swept term. Under the carpet. As
yes.
a society, we don't really address this. Mm-hmm. We say, well, they're lawbreakers as adults. Mm-hmm. Lock them up. Throw away mm-hmm. the key.
I went into to adopt a cat the other day at the Humane Society here. I went through quite a questionnaire, a written questionnaire. Then I was questioned about where the cat would live and how many hours a day it would be home alone and all this kind of stuff. And I said to the woman, I've just gone through a whole lot more investigation to get this cat than I went through when I became a foster parent.
And see, that would be funny if it weren't mm-hmm. true.
It is true. The way I became a foster parent, I was working a case one time in one of the villages out of Nome that we could drive to, and there was a social worker had a case in the same village, so we shared the ride. And on the way, I asked her what do social workers do. Anyway, I was that naive, and she told me about all the stuff they do and that they also take care of foster parents. And so I said, gee, well. You might come by sometime. My wife might be interested in something like that. Well, we might be. And the next day, she was on the doorstep with an infant with a box of Pampers.
Wow.
And that was our introduction. That didn't work out well because we had a son in diapers at the time. And my wife did not want to be changing two kids' diapers, especially when one was not her kid. So
right.
So they took the baby back. But a week or so later, they showed up begging us to take this 8-year-old who was coming in from the village. And we had no place to put her. And we said, we don't have any place. Oh, just put up a curtain over the couch or something like that, and begged us to take this kid. We had had no training, no nothing at that point. And so,
wow. Right?
Yeah. That kid wound up living with me on and off for a lot of years.
Which was probably really good for the kid.
She said that, yeah. She said, if only she could have stayed with us. What right. happened was she was with us, could have stayed with us, and then a law passed called the Indian Child Welfare Act, which in theory is a very good law. And basically what it says is if a child is taken from a native home, they have to go to a native home. Now, this child was half white, and I pleaded, you know, she's half white, but no, she lived in the village. And it turned out the village wanted her back. I don't know why. So she went back, and 2 or 3 years later, she was in a
one of those places.
Yeah, a child. I can't think of the term right now.
A child treatment center?
Yes. Yeah, that's not exactly the term I was looking for, but yes. Yeah. And they had gotten a waiver for us to have her. They called the law ECWA, Indian mm-hmm. Child Welfare Act. Like I said, in theory, it's a very good thing, right. but there needs to be exceptions, and they made an exception for her.
Good.
And by then, the village no longer wanted her.
And it was not too late for her? I mean,
it was. She was a mess, and she'd take two steps forward and one back, you know, and eventually wound up not too bad.
It's one of the things that really disturbs me about people who see the world in there. It's either black or white.
Yes,
mm-hmm. you know, because there are so many things that happen to us.
There, but for fortune,
right? That completely shape who we are mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. think how we think. I mean, nutrition is a huge deal. if you're not getting the proper nutrition in those first few years, your brain has not formed correctly.
Well, and if you're getting beaten.
Yes, or if you're getting beaten, absolutely. Yes.
And there are just, all kinds of forms of abuse.
Yes.
I've seen kids who are living in absolute squalor. I mean, and by that, I mean, you look inside the home and there's old hamburger wrappers over here and the cat's whatever's mm-hmm. over there. And the whole room is just filled with trash, essentially.
Right.
And they're living in this.
Right, right. So you can imagine the germs and the disease. Mm-hmm.
I've been in many of those, yeah. There's a lot of life situations out there that you barely know exist.
Yeah.
And it's appalling to me. And then we make judgments about those people, right? We don't know anything about their background or what they came up with or, and how they were trained or taught or whatever. And we make judgments about them and we don't... as a country, we don't seem to have empathy about.
I think that's human nature.
Do you?
Just my observation after 73 years of walking around on the planet. It just seems to me that in general, people tend to not want to look at the problems. I remember my father once saying that he went to Mexico once, never again. And the reason was he just got so depressed looking at the poverty that the people were living in there and didn't want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's human nature to just kind of turn a blind eye to whatever the problem is. And it would probably be safe to say that we could fix a lot of things if we would just turn and pay attention to them. But I don't think humanity does that.
But do you think, that's a pretty broad sweeping statement. I mean, I think that there are certainly some of us that don't do that.
Right. Yeah, the world's full of all kinds of good Samaritans who are devoting their lives to doing all sorts of great things. They're also the ones who are underpaid.
Overworked.
They're overworked the whole bit.
Yeah.
But what is important is Whitey's on the moon. What is important is that there's a football game coming up in a couple of weeks.
Right, what is
important? There are all these other things that are more important than saving our society.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's my soapbox for the moment.
Yeah, well, it was a good soapbox. I like that.
I think I have to explain your reference, don't I?
Go ahead. Go for it.
Whitey on the Moon is the name of a song by Gil Scott-Heron that I play pretty frequently on my show. It's only about 2 minutes long. And... Gil Scott-Heron was, I guess you'd call him, a beat poet. He's dead now. He went through all the drugs and jail and all that kind of stuff. But he writes some very interesting lyrics. And one of his songs is called Whitey on the Moon. And he's talking about Whitey's on the moon. And while Whitey's on the moon, his sister got bit by a rat and it's swelling up and she can't get medical care and all the... Basically saying... What the hell are we spending all that money to put this guy on the moon when my sister gets bit by a rat and she's swelling up and there's no medical care and my rent is being raised and all that? It's my favorite song. One of. I have a lot of favorite songs with that.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm actually going to play that song on my next show and introduce it by referring to Whitey on the Wall. I think $5.7 billion could be better spent on education or healthcare.
So you guys are out doing your thing and whatever. How did you end up in Brookings?
Because
this seems to be a far cry from either one of you.
We were snowbirding after I retired. We went as far as Key West every year in my motorhome, and we got tired of doing that. And we decided, well, maybe we'll just sell the homestead and move outside someplace. And so one day we were in Fairbanks and happened to mention that to a friend that we're thinking maybe we might want to move. That night, we got a phone call from that guy's cousin who had been to our house cutting firewood, and he wanted to come look at the house and with the idea of buying it. And he brought another guy. We had make a long story short, we sold it in 2 days. And to sell a house in that area is impossible because the town was 500 people. And we wanted a lot of money for it, and it was a non-conventional house and all that. They came the next day with an offer, which was exactly what we want, and it sailed right through. And amazingly, the place was sold. And my
we
wife.
We want you out of here now.
Yeah.
Even with all the knife holes in the wall.
So
there
how?
Were no, there were no knife holes, but I will tell you this. Anybody that's familiar with a sawzall, which it's a reciprocal saw and it has a blade that different various lengths, and it's really great for like cutting and you can turn and you can do that, and if you want to take down a wall or something like that. And I wasn't uncommon for me to forget that there was another end to that saw. And one day I was cutting something out in the bathroom and Gina came screaming down the hall saying, "Stop!" And I was about to, I'd actually started to cut into an electric box on the other side of the
wall. Oh my goodness.
So they didn't have those holes, but I did fix them.
All right, so, but Brookings. So, you're kicked out of your house in
Gina happened to talk to a friend of hers who lives in Ashland, said we were looking for a place that had a decent temperature. She didn't want to be too cold or too hot. And,
right.
And, you have to go to Brookings. Brookings is the best place. Temperature's great. So Gina Googled it and did all the stuff and looked at the real estate. And next thing I knew, we were moving to Brookings. And we loaded everything into a trailer that we wanted to bring and I just drove to Brookings without any idea of going anyplace else. Some friends of ours came up from Sedona to help us look for a house and said, don't you think you might just want to like rent a place here for a while and see if you really like it? I said, no, I'm not moving again. That's it. We're moving to Brookings. Things fell into place here, too.
Yeah. And they do. My experience is that they fall into place when you're where you're supposed to be. They just do. What about you, Dan? How'd you get here?
I'm realizing that I really have had this kind of affection for the Pacific Northwest, and I don't know why. I just have. And at any rate, I was filling out, there were a group of us and a buddy of mine and I working at the juvenile prison were filling out our retirement forms because, it's that time, a couple of months away and whatnot, so we're filling out all of the papers. And I said to him, I wonder, where would be a good place to retire? Because I was starting to think about that. Well, he was from Eugene. He originally was from Tulsa, and he had come back to Tulsa because his parents were elderly and he needed to give them assistance. But at any rate, he was from Eugene. He spent a lot of years there, and he said, well, I'll tell you a little secret. And so I went home, put Brookings in my search engine, and it was on the Pacific Northwest coast, and it looked pretty, and I thought, well, why not? And
here you are.
I wound up getting a divorce. Actually, I was already divorced when I was considering where I was going to go, but I had divorced, so I didn't have any real ties of any sort. Mm-hmm. And so I just essentially started packing up and heading this way. And then Teresa came along, and I said, well, I'm going to Brookings. She said, well, I've never been there, but let's go look.
Aww.
So here we are.
That's great.
Yeah.
So how'd you get involved with KCIW?
I don't really remember. I think
I talked you into it.
Ah.
Ray talked me into
Ray's
it.
It's Ray's fault. How did you get involved then, Ray?
Dan talked me into it.
Wait a second.
I think I did.
I was one of these kids that grew up with radio, and I was fascinated. That song, the Queen song, Radio Gaga, I loved that, and I loved the thought of it. And I always wanted to be a disc jockey when I was a kid, but I didn't know anything about that, and I knew I didn't have the personality to be a disc jockey. So I ran into Tom one day, and I said, you need somebody to sweep up or move furniture or something like that. In the meantime, Dan is putting together this Brookings Cafe idea, and I thought, that's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but okay, I'll go play with you. And there I was.
I love that.
So when I saw the studio, it was obvious they needed nobody to sweep up or to move furniture. So eventually wound up doing a program.
Because there's a rug on the floor, just letting people know.
Well, I shouldn't have said need anybody, but nobody does sweep up. So.
Yeah, that's true. And Dan, how about you? How did you get involved?
I think it was just thinking there was a call for programs from KCIW, and I think it was Linda Bozak who kept coming along and saying, you know, do you know anybody who has a program to put on the radio or whatever? And I just was thinking what would be easy to do, because I'm basically a lazy guy. what would be easy to do and conceivably interesting. And so then I thought, well, you know, the letters to the editor section is always interesting in the paper. Sometimes that's the only part I bother to read. And so I thought, well, you know, if I could get a bunch of people around a table to just discuss things, whatever. And so my original vision was to bring in a few people. We started off with four people, I think, at the table, which is just about right, number-wise. And I didn't really see the cast moving around all that much, but it did. It started to migrate kind of on its own as we had discussions on various topics. We wanted somebody who was up on this particular topic or whatever, so we would start inviting people in. And so far, so good. I still would like to see it be more of people lined up outside the door waiting to come in and have their turn to say whatever they want to say in their 5 minutes on the radio. People are too busy, I guess, like I envisioned when I came here. I didn't envision being in radio or doing anything. I just wanted to come sit on the beach, watch the waves, drink my scotch, and write really, really bad poetry.
There we go.
And so far, I can still write really, really bad poetry.
And you can still drink your scotch, and you can occasionally sit on the beach.
I did that once.
Okay.
On the beach with the scotch. Okay. I did that once.
Yeah, because right now, I think the waves are breaking like at 30 feet or something, so you may not want to be sitting on the beach.
Well, no, they're still fun.
Oh, yeah.
I like storms. I like watching big waves. I don't, for some
I do
reason,
too. You
I'm
just don't want to get too close
idiot
to
idiot in the sense that I do know to back up away from a car that's on fire.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, I tend to stand too close to the edge.
Of course. So what about you, Ray? What show do you do?
I have a show that plays socially significant music. I consider myself KCIW's voice of reason.
Okay, I like that.
I play music with a message, and spice that up with clear and very well thought out, insightful observations on my part.
And I can see the tongue-in-cheek thing happening here.
Excuse me?
Excuse me.
And I would like to point out before we go any further that in solidarity with the federal workers that are not being paid right now, all of us are appearing with no salary. Today, yesterday,
and the day before, and the day before that.
I'm not getting paid?
Oh, I'm so sorry, Dan.
They told me $100.
Did I neglect to tell you that? I'm so sorry. Yeah. So what do you like best about playing around with radio? What's your favorite part?
I just think it's kind of fun, and I get to, you know, through the week, I'll hear things or see things on the news, and then I get to sit down and make comments about those things in an offhand way, or try to find some music that goes with it or something like that. And I think it's kind of fun.
Is it hard to find the music?
No. There's plenty of music out there, and if I usually what I do is I'll go to the computer and I'll type in songs about war and get songs about war, songs about poverty, songs about racial equality, things like that. And it takes me usually about an hour to put together 15 or so songs to do a show.
Mm-hmm. Thank God for the internet.
Yes. Yeah.
What did we do before the internet?
I went to my record collection. And when I started to conceive this idea, I looked at it and I said, oh, yeah, I got this. And you know how that is. You're looking through 100 and you say, oh, I could do this for a year.
Right.
No, the record collection lasted about 2 shows.
And you've done a lot of discussions. There's been quite a few shows. Dan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talked about, what have you talked about?
Oh, we've talked about, let's see, we've talked about paranormal. We've talked about death with dignity. That's some of the recent ones. We had a
couple of shows about guns.
We had a couple of shows about guns. Actually, one of them specifically about guns, and that was after some of the more horrific school shootings.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about, we haven't really touched on politics too much. And part of this, just because I don't really, even though I worked with politics for many years in the advertising business, I just really don't know a whole heck of a lot about politics, really. I don't, maybe I know too much, and therefore I realize I don't know anything at all.
Right.
But, so I'm a little hesitant to do that, although, and the other thing is that right now, if you start talking about politics, it's a hot subject.
Oh, it's so...
You know, everybody gets all upset about it. So I think maybe, you know, in another year or so, you know, maybe we might get into more of these things. The last show that we did, which is not on the air yet, we talked about what is democracy?
Well, that's a good
question. You know, what life actually is and what we think it is are oftentimes two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
So I would like to see more discussions on what's important to our location. One of the problems I have is finding people who, in fact, want to come and represent the other point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I've invited people. I've sent out emails and said, you know, I know that you I tend to think along these lines. Would you like to come and be representative of that? And so far, it's a no-show.
Right.
Which is very surprising. You'd think people would want to jump at the chance to come mm-hmm. express their views. And not necessarily political ones or mm-hmm. controversial ones, mm-hmm. but it's kind of hard to find people to come at all sometimes. I really had to work hard
Everybody's
to find
on
some
the
people
beach
to come
drinking
in and talk about
scotch.
Religion. What?
Everybody's on the beach drinking scotch.
Under the 30-foot wave.
Yeah, right.
So is there a way that people who do want to discuss things can get in touch with you?
Yeah, they can just simply go to the website or send an email to contact@kciw.org. That website is actually the magic ingredient. It's the key to everything that we do here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if a listener is asking themselves right now, okay, this discussion at Brookings Cafe or a Ray show, what's going on? How do I hear those shows? You go to kciw.org, and there you will find programs and then the show schedule, and then you can listen online to a lot of the programs. Right. Unfortunately, not Ray's. I really wish that was possible to
do. We can't podcast the music shows.
We can't podcast, but there's the show schedule.
Right,
right. And so...
And we are on the radio at 100.7 FM, so you can listen.
We would like people to use that website, or the website, as well, to comment on what they think of our shows. We have no way of knowing... Other than, you know, what our family thinks of them or what our friends think of them or something. You know, if you think that what we're doing is terrible, let us know. If you love what we're doing or if you have a suggestion for something else we can do.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah,
or if you want to do your own show or, I mean, this is a community radio station and I like to think of it as being a mirror that people can turn to KCIW and they can essentially see themselves here.
I like that. Well, guess what, guys? We're out of time.
Well, wait a minute. I've got 37 more pages in my resume here.
I'm so sorry, but that's going to have to wait until the next show.
You know, very often that's what we come up with. Like at our discussion shows, when we're done, we say, well, we need to do this again because we didn't cover anything.
I know. Yeah. I often do that with my guests. It's like, well, you're going to have to come back because we just didn't catch everything. So, but thank you very much, both of you, for coming on. It was delightful. I had a really good time.
Well, thanks for
having
us. We
did, too. Do I get my $100 now?
You get no $100.
I think Crescent City is going to pay us.
And thank you for listening. I've been talking with Ray Gary and Dan Sherman, two of our great family of volunteers here at KCIW. If you have some skills to offer and want to have fun with a great group of people, go to our website, kciw.org, and fill out a volunteer application form. While you're there, become a member for $25 a year or sponsor a show. All of your donations help keep us on the air, providing good quality local programming. Thanks for listening. This is Our Community, and I'm Candace Michelle.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.